If you're like me, you love and miss that golden era of Christian music. From the Jesus music of the 70s, the monster vocalists of the 80s, and the creativity and risk-taking of the 90s and early 2000s. I'm Andy Christman, and for the past four decades, I was privileged to be smack dab in the middle of this crazy and beautiful thing that we call CCM. As a member of the group For Him, I got to know so many great people with even greater stories, and I don't want to keep these stories to myself. That's why I created One Degree of Andy, so you can join me as I reminisce with my friends and colleagues. My hope is that as you experience these conversations, you'll go back and listen to that golden era of music and fall in love all over again, just like I have. This is the One Degree of Andy podcast. One of the storylines that just continues to pop up in so many of these conversations that I have with artists on the podcast is that their Christian music career is completely overshadowed by what they do after. And that is the story of my friend Brian White. You may remember him from the group Brian White and Justice from the late 80s and early 90s. They definitely had some hits, but you're going to love hearing from Brian and how God took him into the country music field and some of the songs that he wrote. And I just love sitting down with him because he's one of my favorite people in the whole world. We'll get to his conversation in just a minute, but I want to remind you to consider becoming a premium member. So many of you are doing that every single week, and man, it really helps the show to go to the next level. If you want to be a part of that, you can go to my website, andychristman.com, and sign up there. It's super easy. And in return, you will get early access to every one of these episodes, and you'll get exclusive video content as well. So again, go to my website, andychristman.com, and consider becoming a premium subscriber. Now, here is my awesome conversation with my good friend, Brian White. Brian White and Justice.
Oh my God.
That's how I first remember you. I know that you wrote some songs and your name's on a lot of For Him songs, but I was kind of clueless back in those days. Like
I was too.
I knew who most of the major players were in Christian music, but I didn't know who was co-writing on most of the songs we were doing. But I know we crossed paths a lot. Yes. We became friends back in the early days. And it's just always great to run across you and your wife, Karen. And you guys are just, have become just dear friends. And
we've had some good times.
Yeah, we have. And so I really think that you have quite a storyline in the history of Christian music and beyond. And one of the things I love about so many of the artists that come on the podcast is that their second or third act's bigger than their first act. Mm. You know, that they started out in Christian music and had a career, but then, changed lanes. And then that's when they really started to see some major success. So we'll get into all that, but I'm just excited to have Brian White on the One Degree of Andy podcast.
Loved it. I finally feel like I've made it because all my buddies were in here and everybody else is coming on. And they're going, have you done Andy's podcast yet? And I go, no.
Not that you haven't been asked.
Yeah.
That I haven't sent you a few texts.
You have. And it's been kind of getting coordinated with schedules. And I feel honored to be here, man.
I'm glad to have you. Like I said, you and Karen are friends and it's good to see you a couple times a year. And
yeah. We did the gig out in Tulsa together, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah. So let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to your entry into Nashville and tell me the story of how you ended up here.
Well, I when I got out of college, I'd always loved music and I played baseball in college. That's what I thought I would do. I wanted to be a professional baseball player.
How many people are here that started out playing baseball? Feel several teams.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys that that had those aspirations, and there are guys that did. I mean, I'm a good friend with Barry Zito, who is now doing music here in Nashville, but Barry's a Cy Young Award winner and a World Series winner and all that. But, I think it's the joke that we've always said, rock stars want to be sports stars, sports stars want to be rock stars. Everybody, there's a little bit of that. But I kind of messed my knee up, and that kind of ended that chase. But I'd always done music in college, and I loved kids, and so I was a youth pastor.
What college?
I went to Mount Vernon Nazarene University up in Mount Vernon, Ohio.
And were you there on a baseball? Yeah. Were you there on a baseball scholarship?
Yeah, I was playing baseball. And so You know, I loved kids, and we sang during the summer. I traveled with a PR group from the school, and we did a lot of conferences and camps, and so music was always a part of that. So fast forward all that, when I got out of college, I became a youth pastor, and I was a youth pastor for 10 years and took a position here in Nashville my last 4 years. And when I left the church I was in Iowa for 4 years, out in the middle of corn and pigs and freezing my rear end off. but when I got the call to come to Nashville, my pastor said, you go to Nashville, you'll never leave. You love music, and that's where you're going to fall in love with that. And it happened. I just, you know, I got here and I got kind of hooked into the songwriting thing through a good buddy, Dave Clark. Dave challenged me. I asked him a question. I said, well, tell me about this songwriting thing. He goes, do you write? And I said, well, I got a few songs. He goes, well, let me see them. And I was like, nah, you're like a professional. And he said to me, well, I guess you'll never know. And I went home that night.
That sounds like Dave.
Yeah. I thought, man, I don't want to go through the rest of my life wondering if I could do this. So I gave him a couple songs, and he took them into the Benson Company and John Barker. And John called me and said, hey, Dave brought these songs. We like these. We'd love to talk to you. And so the one thing led to another. I got a few cuts on a guy named Brent Lamb and another guy named Bobby Michaels. And then that started to move forward into other cuts and with Al Denson, you guys, you know. But I got involved in the songwriting, and I was still at heart doing youth ministry and speaking and singing at camps and stuff. And so I had somebody say, well, you need to make a record. And I was like, well, why would I make a record? I'm not an artist.
Yeah.
And they said, well, these kids at these camps, they would love to hear your music. And Don Cook, who our dear friend who passed recently, Don and I, Don said, well, let's do a record, man. And so I did a couple independent things, and I did one, and we were more like, I jokingly say, I mean, I had a good mullet back in the day. And
didn't we all?
Yeah, we did. You did too.
Yeah,
man.
It
was that thing. But I jokingly said, you know, like, well, we were like Bon Jovi for Jesus. You know, it was a rock thing.
Yeah.
And we finished the record, and a guy, a lady out in LA got a hold of it, Alyssa Elder, and she worked for Maranatha Music. Yeah. And they had a rock label called Broken Records. And they called and said, we love your record, and we'd love to talk to you about, you know, a record deal. And I was like, I'm a youth pastor, you know, in my mind.
Yeah.
But it was the Lord kind of moving me and changing my focus from shepherding a flock of kids, basically, to being evangelistic. And that was it, man. I started writing more and getting – I was a rock guy, but I was getting cuts with Larnell Harris, you know. So it's like, you know, it's kind of this weird kind of thing. And, but it was God. It was so cool. It was a season of my life for about 15 years that I toured and played. And I think that's where we met. You actually sang on one of you guys, you and Kirk did backups on one of my records.
That's right.
And I remember you guys coming out there and Bob Carlisle, it was you and Kirk and Bob Carlisle. And I'm standing there. Don goes, you need to get out there and sing so we get your texture in there. And I remember standing out there and I felt like Donny Osmond with the rock band. I was like, who am I, man? These guys are, you know, and you guys are just like nailing these things. But it was a great season in my life. And the songwriting never stopped.
Mm-hmm.
But for, you know, ended up thinking we did four records. We moved on to sign with Diadem, which was me and Bob Carlisle and Kim Boyce. And then my last record was with Steve Griffith, and Steve was in a group called Vector with Charlie Peacock and Jimmy Abegg. So there was a whole bunch of things that were happening. And, but the songwriting was always in my heart there.
What was your first big hit as a songwriter?
In Christian music, my first single was with a guy named Brent Lamb.
Right.
And we had written a song called Another One Snatched Away. And I'll never forget, there was 20, the Countdown magazine.
Yeah. John Rivers.
Yeah. And I'll never forget the first time they said, your song's at number 20 and it's moving up the chart. I was like, I'll be on the magazine. So, you know, I still got the cassette, you know. So, but that was probably the first radio success.
Yeah.
My first number one was a song I wrote with Don and Dave called Everything You Are that was recorded by Larnell Harris.
Okay.
And that'll always be dear to me in light of Don's passing. That song will always be special to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, kind of going back to Don's passing, that was, you know, we're going to end up mentioning it in this on several of these podcasts because, you know, it's amazing. Again, with all the different artists that have been on these episodes, we all have these central touch points, right? Whether it's Estes Park, Young Messiah, you know, we're all on the same label at the same time, or, you know, we had somebody in common like Don, who, you know, without Don, where would our careers be? I don't know where For Him's career would be. And you could probably say the same thing for yours. Where would your career be without a guy like Don? And so it was amazing to see all of these artists and executives, former record executives and songwriters all gather at the church to pay respect to Don.
It was healing for all of us.
Yeah, it really was.
You know, and I actually had a conversation on the way in this morning to do this podcast. A buddy of mine called and he said, man, he was there. He said, it was just unreal. He goes, I think there was a lot of people from the secular side of the industry that were there to pay their respects that did not realize all that Don had done.
Yeah.
And walked out with their jaws on the floor going, oh my gosh. And I said, well, he's iconic. I mean, you're talking 40 number ones with some of the biggest artists in our industry during that time frame of music, which I loved that time frame of music.
And when we say 40 number ones, that doesn't account for four times as many or five times as many that were charting songs that everyone from that era would know.
Everybody wanted a Don Cook production or a Don Cook song. There was just his melodies were amazing.
They were.
And the cool thing to me was, you know, I was a rock guy, and Don was producing my first couple independent records, and they were rock things. And Don got that. And then all of a sudden, he'd be over here playing some smaltzy, why I wonder why, for this group called For Him. And I always joked and said, man, you're doing the rock thing. Now you're doing, but it was just, it was cool. And that time frame when we were touring, you know, we never toured together, but we were touring at the same time.
Yeah, we would see each other at festivals and, or, you know, buses pass each other on the highway, anything like that.
Our bus, I remember our bus blew up in Nacogdoches, Texas.
Oh, wow.
And my buddies in New Song were playing in Dallas that night.
Yeah.
And so I called them. And so their bus was already full, but they loaded me and my band in their bus to get us back to Nashville. But it was that kind of thing. Yeah. Like, hey, you're going to help us out.
Oh, that happened a lot. Yeah.
We were all out there together.
So did you enjoy touring? Did you enjoy the band life and the touring life? And was that something that you felt like you were born to do? Or was it a little bit of a...
I loved it. You know what? It's kind of crazy what we did as artists. You're in a bus for, you know, 8 hours driving through the night, and you get there and you set up and da 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 da, and you get that 2 hour, 2.5 hour moment on stage with where you're connecting with people. And for us, we were very evangelistic in what we did. And so that was really important to us to see students making commitments and decisions for the Lord. And then you get back on the bus and you go, wow, I do all of this for that 2.5 hour window.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it was a calling. I think the Lord calls us, and it's not for everybody. Yeah. My wife is an artist, and you know, and I said, you never had to do, we started out in a van pulling out, you know, a U-Haul trailer. Then it was a minibus, like one of airport shuttles. So, you know, it's a lot different these days, the touring and stuff, but it was a calling. And I loved it up to a point. I love being home now. You know, I love being kind of writing songs, and you go out there and sing them.
Oh man, that airport shuttle thing, that a lot of artists had that, because, you know, you could probably buy them pretty cheap. You could retrofit it just a little bit. And did it have a bathroom in it?
No, we had like three bunks and a little storage unit in the back. And then, you know, bathrooms were the side of the road in the middle of the night you know, somewhere. And, but the funny thing about those airport shuttles, they're not made to haul long, you know, drive it for 7 hours
straight. Those engines aren't going to last.
We burned through some of those. Oh, we burned through more axles on a trailer than you could count. And so when I was able to purchase a bus, which I was one of the dumb ones, I bought a bus instead of renting it. I bought a bus from the
same.
It was like the old Imperials bus at one point.
Yeah. These things are black. They're money holes.
Oh, every time a tire needed replaced, every time anything. I'm going, well, everything I made this weekend is going to do that, you know. But again, I look back and laugh at that and go, man, God, you were good in the midst of all that.
Yeah.
We were living the dream kind of, you know. It's like, wow, we're out here playing rock star for Jesus, you know. But I loved that season of my life. And my wife jokingly says, you had like three lives. You know, you were a youth pastor for 10 years, and then you toured as an artist for 10 years, and now you're doing this. It's like, yeah, and it's kind of God moving your heart maybe a little bit, like, oh, now I'm really passionate about this. Not that I'm not passionate about the other things, but to climb back in a bus right now, I don't think I'd be up for it.
I've done it. I did it not that long ago thinking, I can do this again. Oh, man. It's hard on the back. It's hard on the,
I wasn't hard on the
stomach. It's hard on the brain and the smells. And
oh my gosh.
I'm just like, I don't know. I'd rather just jump in a plane and get there. But
exactly.
Yeah. Who was in your band? So tell me about the band.
That were in my band, my drummer was a guy named Chad Chapin. Mm-hmm. Chad went on when it came off the road, he went on to play for Ben Folds and just a great drummer. Bill Randall was my keyboard player, and Bill went on to play for Rebecca St. James. My bass player was a guy named Mike Brandenstein, and he went on. He played some with Petra and others. And then my guitar player was a guy named Steve Dinch, and Steve went on to do his own thing, moved to L.A. And the fun thing is we get together every now and then if we all come back to town, and we'll go have coffee somewhere, and then we look at old pictures when we all had hair.
Yeah.
They were good dudes, the last 5 years, and it was unusual in at least in our role as in the rock side of it that to maintain a band that somebody didn't come along and offer them a better gig, a little more money, and then they're gone. Well, you're constantly replacing somebody, so the last 5 years we were all together, and we actually our last record. We recorded as a band, which was cool. It was a lot of times it was session guys, and then you go, okay, guys, go learn how to play these. Like, go learn how to play that Dan Huff lick, and learn how to play that Dan Needham drum fill or whatever. This was us doing the record, so the last 5 years was a lot of fun.
Yeah, is unusual, and you hear that from a lot of bands that they weren't the ones that actually played on the record because they're two different skill sets.
Oh, totally.
Really?
Well, you can be because the studio, well, you know, it's very clinical. You're going to hear every little fret buzz and every little thing, and your gear might have a buzz in it that you don't hear live.
Yeah.
And it's just a whole different thing.
Well, there's a time restraint too, because it's not like you're going to, like a big time secular band is going to go in for 2 years and make a record and just live in the studio and create. I mean, we're on tight budgets here and you know, you got half a day to get this track and half a day to get this track.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of work to be done in a short amount of time. And so, a lot of the live guys that are really good live, there's just a transition to being that, to being a pro in the studio as well. Is. Yeah.
And a lot of guys wanted to transition into the studio because then they could stay home and they could still make a living and they're still getting to do what they love to do. So the road was it's for the young guys. You know, I laugh now because I got, I write for younger artists and they're like, yeah, man, we're out on the road and they're happy eating Taco Bell three times a day, whatever, dude, I just know, but there has to be that, there has to be that little bit of understanding on their side that like when we're going into the studio, we might replace part because we need it to be precise. And you're great live, but maybe that's a little loose for the record. So.
Yeah.
And my guys understood that, but they all wanted to play, obviously, but you hear about bands like U2 and the Eagles and all those guys where they just go, we rented a place and we're out here for, 5 weeks, just kind of, we didn't do that. Well, you're like, you got 3 days, get in there and track it.
Then you got to get back on the road.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the only way you're making money.
Yeah.
Is, hopefully you have, a couple of big songs that can bring some royalties in and a little bit of mailbox money. But, for the most part, you got to get out there and tour. We've had this conversation with several people, and it was a story for him. I'm sure it was with you. It's, just make a record, tour, make a record, tour, make a record, tour. And especially when you've got a band and you've got a booking agent, a management team and a label and all these people working together, you don't go take 6 months off. No. You don't take a year off and go,
you can't do it.
What are we going to do next? No, next thing you're going to do is go back and write and make another record.
Well, the funny thing for me was, like, we were never the huge, you know, successful on the charts. We had a couple songs that did really well for us, but my successes came from my writing, and that kind of was helping fuel paying for, okay, yeah, well, we're not on the front cover of CCM magazine, but Michael English is, and he's singing. So it was one thing was feeding the other. And it was a part of the heartbeat of what I loved was sharing. And then writing again for other artists was like, yeah, I want to do that too. And so one kind of melded into the other. And so I said goodbye to the road and hello to home. And
so let's talk about that. So you mentioned, and you know, Karen saying you've had three acts in your life, three different, and I hear that so much. I'm the same way, that the third act tends to be the culmination of the first two, or that there's totally been this little muscle that you have strengthened all the way through the first two that now you can pay more attention to that. And again, some of the artists that I've had on, their third act is just like, what? Kind of leaves that whole CCM career in the dust, which is, I can say that if it, you know, doesn't put down what you did in the past. Right. It's a progression of what you're able to, the relationships you made and the, you know, what you focused on as far as your gift. So let's talk about that transition out of, you know, your CCM career.
Right.
Tell me how it ended. And then what you did to transition off the road and into a full-time career as a writer.
Well, I'd always written. And when I was signed to the Benson Company, you know, I would be out on the road and they'd say, hey, there's this group. Don would call me. Hey, I'm producing East to West. At that time, they were brand new. And he could say, there's a guy who wants to send you a track. Can you write a lyric to it? And I'm out on the bus. And so I'm writing a lyric, you know, and then I'm faxing it, you know, because they're not texting.
Because you're between Omaha and Des Moines.
Exactly.
You know, I got time for that.
So that, you know, that was great for me in writing. And I knew that was a muscle I really loved.
But
I had toured, like I said, about 15 years. And unfortunately, I went through a divorce and that was hard. And there's a point where you think, well, I'm done. Mm-hmm. No one wants to hear what a divorce guy has to say, but God's very redemptive and very, you know, his mercy is amazing. But so that I came off the road and I really focused on the writing and spent more time doing that. And as that started to develop, and I, like I said, while I was touring, I was still writing and was having successes. It was funny. I think one of the things that Broken Records used as a promo piece in a CCM magazine was, well, you've heard Michael English sing his songs. You've heard Larnell Harris sing his songs. Now hear him sing his songs. You know, so I was doing that all along, but this was now, I'm not doing the artist thing. Now I'm just focused on writing. And I loved that, getting up and being intentional about going in and saying, okay, who are we writing for? Who are we looking at? And I signed with Don and I signed with a company called Pamplin Music.
Right.
And we were there for a couple of years. And during that time then, one of the funny side stories is they came to me and said, hey, you are a youth pastor. You know how to handle teenagers. And we just signed this teenage girl. So we want you to A&R her record and work with her.
Is that Nikki?
No, it was Katie Hudson, who is Katy Perry.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
Yeah, so here I have this 17-year-old doing cartwheels down the hall, trying to get her in a room to write songs. She's wanting to run over to the mall because the studio is close by. But because I was a youth pastor, I kind of knew how to, you know, talk her language, so to speak. But during that time, you know, so there I was, now Katy Perry, you know, worldwide superstar. But it was an interesting time. Now I was kind of delving into doing a little different things as well as writing. Mm-hmm. Okay, I can A&R, I can produce.
Yeah.
And so then I signed at BMG and because 2 years at Pamplin, and then it kind of went away. Uh-huh. It just, I think they were like, okay, this didn't work. And Don and I were like, okay. So Don, I think, signed at Word. I don't know. And I got signed at BMG. BMG had a country division. And a Christian division. So when you'd walk in the morning, the secretary's sitting there, and one hallway to the left was the Christian side, and the hallway to the right was the country side. Mm-hmm. I called it the sheep and the goats, you know, but the goats had the coffee pot. So I started going down every morning to get coffee, and I'm standing there hanging out with these writers like Craig Weissman and Ed Hill and Chris Lindsay and Amy Mayo. And these are huge country writers who have written for Tim McGraw and Garth and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm just standing there going, oh my gosh, this is a whole nother world. And, one time during that, I'd written a song with a buddy of mine, Rodney Clawson, and he pitched it and they put it on hold for Faith Hill. Well, their Faith's people called BMG and they called the countryside and they said, hey, we putting this song on hold and your writer, Brian White. And they were like, nah, we don't have a guy named Brian White. And one of the guys goes, oh, that's the guy up on the Christian side. And, so they called up there, and my publisher came to me and said, hey, they want to talk to you down in the countryside. And I was like, oh, man, I've been drinking too much coffee, apparently. You know, I'm thinking that's it. So,
but well, anyway. And let me interject here, too. Just from hearing so many of these stories of people who have had success in both lanes, it's not common. Am I right in that? That there's not that the door's not open, but it feels like there's a little bit of a, sure. There's a gulf there to be able to be welcome on the other side from being a Christian writer to now being on the country side of things.
Well, and it's because they kind of pigeonhole you both sides, sure. The Christian division and the country division, mm-hmm. Like, oh, you're a Christian writer. You write, you know, and then the country guys go, well, you write, you know, cowboys and beer and stuff, you know, whatever. And it is, it's kind of like, okay, you do that, and we do this, and but we're owned by the same company, but never the two shall meet, you know. Yeah. And so when I'm standing down there in this office, and they're going, hey, well, what else you got? And we like this song, and I jokingly call it, we wrote it was a love song, and it was kind of like a Jesus is my boyfriend song, you know. It's like could be about God, could be about, you know. It's just this, you know, ambiguous a little bit.
Yeah.
And so, long story short, I gave them some more songs. They invited me to a songwriter camp. And I went back up and told Michael Purrier, who was my publisher at the time, I said, they want me to go to this retreat. And he goes, well, you need to go. They've never invited anybody from the Christian side. And I said, but I mean, man, I don't know those dudes. And I'm, you know, and at the time in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm going to go out here with all these hellraisers and beer drinkers and all that. What am I doing? And I remember riding the bus out to this retreat center with all these guys and women that I didn't know. I was used to my comfortable CCM friends. And it was like the audible voice of God just said to me, go be light. Mm. Just go there and just be light. And so I went, and one of the cool things, my dear friends I met was Don Portress. And Don is a great country writer and also a Christian writer. And he was a worship pastor at his church, but he had some cuts with, you know, Willie Nelson, people like that. So so those other guys were out there having a good time, and we were standing out on the back porch of this retreat center, and we're looking at each other like going, that's not what we do. Not that what they're doing is like, I'm not going to go in there and preach at them, but I'm just more comfortable standing out here. And we kind of started talking, and we hit up a relationship. And so that retreat, I ended up writing with Craig Weissman, which was beyond my wildest dream. I was like, he was the hottest thing in town on the countryside. We ended up writing a song. My first country cut was a song recorded by Trace Atkins, and I wrote with him. But one of the cool things is Don and I got back and we realized, man, there's something here that we have a kindred spirit because of our relationship with the Lord. And we wrote, and one of the first songs we ever wrote was a song called The Promise that the Martins recorded, Southern Gospel Group. And that went on to be a song of the year for We Run the Devil, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it was just, and I thought, you know, if I hadn't gone on that retreat, you know, I would have missed that. I would have missed this relationship. And I equate it a lot of times when, you know, we hear Jesus calling the disciples and they, the one thing that hit me is when Christ called them, they responded immediately. Mm-hmm. They didn't go, hey, let me kind of go think about this because
a few did. Yeah. Let me go bury my parents. Right. Let me go, you know,
he would have kept moving and you wouldn't have had Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You'd had, Steve and Joe and Frank and somebody else down because he, you know, and I thought, you know what, when God opened that door. I stepped through it. And so I went back home to my Christian publisher, and I realized, man, I don't want to be put in I don't want to be pigeonholed. If the room calls for me to write a country thing that I can have influence in, I want to do that. But on the same side, I was writing with these country guys who had a desire to write things about their faith that they had. And so that was part three of this act. I'm going, man, all of a sudden now I'm writing with, one day it's a worship song, you know, and then the next day it's a song for Rodney Atkins or whatever.
I think that's so cool because you can bring your spirit, and you're kind of touching on this.
Yep.
You can bring your spirit from the Christian world of what you know what moves people's hearts and what, you know, there is a faith aspect
totally
probably to everything that you write and what you bring to the table. But then when you step into the other side, I'm not to say that they're better writers over there, but it's a different level of what's selling and what, you know, I mean, let's just be honest. I mean, there's a reason they're there and not on the Christian side of things.
Well,
as far as skill set.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, like, I would, and this is so weird because I just had this conversation with a buddy on the way in. And I remember them coming to me, we had gotten a gold record for, I forget who it was for, but on the Christian side. And one of my country buddies, he goes, so what is gold in Christian music? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, like, how many sales? And I said, well, 500,000. He goes, Christian artists are selling 500,000 records? And I was like, yeah, what do you think? It's like 50,000? Like, we kind of downgraded it. Because they had no idea what was going on. And so I was finding these country guys saying, well, man, I got this idea for a Christian song. And so they would say, you know, something like, here it is. Jesus died for me at Calvary to set me free. And I said, well, yeah, okay, we all know that.
We've done that one.
We've done that one. Yeah. So it's not like, and at the same token, I would have Christian guys say, man, I got this country idea. And because they knew I was writing on both sides.
Yeah.
And it would be like, yeah, country is not Southern gospel, just jazzed up a little bit. There's a whole storytelling element that I really love about country music.
Yeah.
It tells stories. And now, and when I look at where the CCM market is today, I mean, you got guys like Zach Williams and Ben Fuller, and I'm trying to think of her name, blonde-headed. Anyway, she's a new artist, and she's amazing. And it's got a country flavoring to it, and they're telling stories. And Cochran and Company, you know. I think he's got a song out right now called Parking Lot that is just like, I found Jesus in a parking lot. And I'm going, that sounds like a country idea.
Yeah, Kane.
Totally. So, but it's been fun for me to not feel like, well, I have to write this.
Yeah.
And my publishers have never tried to, from that point on when things happened at BMG, Michael Purrier was like, man, just go write The Room. You read The Room and write The Room. And if they want you to go in and try to take a stab at a Tim McGraw thing, do that. And if they want you to go over here and take a stab at a Danny Gokey thing, do that. And I felt really free to just be creative then instead of going, well, man, I got to somehow figure out how to turn this thing into a Christian song or vice versa.
Yeah.
And I'm having the time of my life right now, man.
You're a little bit of a unicorn, I think, because I don't know many guys like you that have had that, been able to keep your feet on between, you know, on the other side of the divide, and maybe even just pull that rope and kind of pull everything a little closer together. I mean, I think you're in very rare company that has prestige in that on both sides of things that people go, yeah, he can, we totally call him to write a gospel tune or a Christian tune and a country tune. And, you know,
and you know what? And I think that goes back to that very first trip when I really feel like I heard the Lord speak to me, just go be light. You know, I wasn't going to go in there and, you know, turn or burn, you know, you heathens, you know, and then no one wants to.
Or go in and pretend that you didn't have a life in the Christian realm at all.
My faith is important to me, and I'll never not talk about that.
Yeah.
I still travel. The fun thing is, I don't do the big rock show now. I just sit on the stool. Last night, I played a place here in Nashville called The Listening Room, and you sit on the stool, you tell the stories behind the song. And I'll do my country stuff. You know, they want to hear the Jason Aldean thing or whatever. And then, but also I'll go, but here's a song that really speaks my heart, and I'll sing the promise or something of that nature. And I've never been in a situation where anybody looked at me and said, well, I can't believe you'd sing a country song, or, oh, we don't want to hear your Christian stuff. And I think it's just the way the Lord has mapped my life out at this point, just to say, Brian, you know, I had an old evangelist to say, you know, you catch him and we'll clean him. You know, that's the way the Lord is. Yeah. You go out there and put some bait in the water and let people, because even last night, I wrote a song called Watching You for a guy named Rodney Atkins. And that song has been very good to me. And in it, though, we talk about, we were talking when we wrote it, how Rodney's kid had heard one of his songs and had, you know, said, going through hell. And this kid starts saying hell, and he's like, I don't understand it. Why is he doing that? We're like, well, dude, he's just doing what you do. And he goes, oh yeah. I said, he's watching what you do. He said, we need to write that. So we wrote the first verse kind of in a little tongue in cheek, fun way about that. I said, but you know what's interesting? I said, the second, I said, I remember walking in from school and seeing my dad sitting in his recliner, reading his Bible, or he would come and kneel next to me and pray with me at night. That I was watching too, and that impacted me. So we wrote the second verse about that. Well, to this day, I will get from both sides. People come and go, man, that made me change the way I parented my child. To churches calling saying, hey, can you come and sing that on Father's Day? And I was like, God, aren't you cool? How you just kind of go, you know what? We don't have to divide one or the other. We're going to put it all together. Excuse me. And I kind of laugh and go, you know, only God. You know, it was that day in that room, we didn't set out to write A or B. We just set out to write a song that was truthful.
Yeah.
And,
well, he's a giver of it all.
Yeah.
Every good and perfect gift comes from the Father above. Amen. So, you know, whether you choose to write country music or gospel music or pop music, or, you know, you've got a voice, you've got a skill to play an instrument. It's all from the Lord. Mm-hmm. Right. And you just our whole lives are doing our best to be faithful with that gift and wherever it takes us. And sometimes, you know, we can choose paths that take us to destruction or, you know, or to where we're, you know, we're preaching against what he wants, you know, what his word says or who he is. And that's on us, but the gift stays the same,
right?
You know, no matter who you are, I don't care if you're a metal rocker, you know, you're playing death metal or you're playing, you know, you're playing swampy blues kind of music or whatever. That gift is originally from our Father. And I just love seeing people who maximize it. I love sitting down with my friends who have maximized that gift and just say, I see how far this can go. Cause I think that's God honoring its most basic sense.
Well, I remember when I was, we were doing the Brian White and Justice stuff and that, you know, we had some places, I'm not going to lie, that, you know, we're like, oh, you know, the church was, some of the people in the church, so their long hair and, you know, and the earrings and that music. And the devil's in those drums, you know, and I'd say, nah, he ain't in them because we beat the devil out of them every night. That kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But on the other side, there were like in the country secular market, there were people like, you're Christian, you're going to come in here and start banging us over the head with the Bible and whatever. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I think there's, I've always felt like there's condemn and condone, and then there's compassion. Mm. And we're called to be in the middle. I'm called to have a compassionate heart for my friends that are over here. I'm not going to condone what they're doing, but I'm not going to sit there and point this finger of judgment at them. I'm just going to love them in the middle of it and say, you know what? It's God's, the Holy Spirit's the only one that can change a man's heart. I can't. I can... Hopefully, that the Bible calls us to be salt, to make people thirsty for the living water.
Yeah.
And so that's really kind of what I feel like the Lord has me at this point in my life. Maybe there's an act four. I don't know. I like act three so far. Pretty good, you know. And all those memories of the youth pastoring, and I get text and emails still to this day of like, hey, I was at a youth camp, but you sang at, now I'm a pastor. And that is so cool to me. Or somebody who was a teen in my youth group who calls me up and says, I'm in town. I'd love to get in. We're serving the Lord in this church. Those things are all great memories. And I love that. And I think it's a part of our story and it's a part of the road we walk. My wife and I and get up every day and not knowing what this day holds. I mean, and just going, well, we're going to just step through and let God do his thing. Mm-hmm. Because I've found through the years that God's, Dave Clark, I'm going to quote a Dave Clark lyric. In God's own time, I'll always find his plan for me is greater than any dream of mine. Wow. And I, you know, I had a lot of wild dreams when I was younger, but this plan God has for my life, it's my, you know, calling, I feel, is just to keep moving forward and whatever the day brings.
So. I feel like that's the best way to live. I feel the same way. My wife and I wake up every morning and go, okay, God, what do you have for us today? Yeah. And I think that's part of, you know, that's why in the Lord's Prayer, I think Jesus puts that first. Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy will be done.
Yep, exactly.
Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. You know, so there's a, before we ever get into what we want and need, we're saying, God, what do you want from me today? What?
Exactly.
I would rather do what you want me to do than just to just go do whatever I want to do. And right. sometimes God says, yeah, go do what you want to do and I'll be with you. But there are times I think that I'm a product of this, especially over the last 4 or 5 years, of just going, wow, God, I didn't know we were going to do that. And that's great. I'm glad I waited on you.
Yeah.
And, you know? So, oh, you talk about your wife, tell us about meeting Karen and how that relationship started. Because I just got to say, bro, I mean, come on.
I'm out of my league.
Come on, bro. We all know that.
as I said, I'd gone through a divorce and that was a hard time in my life. But so I was working and producing some records and working with a country guy named Charlie Allen. And Charlie, he would tell you this if he was sitting there. He's a big old redneck boy. He'd talk, hey, Brian. And that's how I talked. Mm-hmm. And Karen had moved here from Orlando and to pursue music. She felt like the Lord had called her to kind of pursue. And she had someone say, well, you need to call this person when you get to Nashville, and they'll help connect the dots.
Well, let's back up a second, because I met Karen a long time ago, because I'd met her dad, Pat Williams, who was first in, wasn't he in, he was in Philadelphia first?
He was the general manager of the Philadelphia 76ers.
Right, and then he moved to Orlando and became the general manager of the
Orlando Magic. Yep.
Right. Oh, he started the Magic, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And so I remember meeting him several times through the years, just a great Christian man, a Christian family, lots of kids.
19 brothers and sisters.
Incredible.
14 adopted from all over the world. It's such a cool story. Yeah. I mean, Pat, when with his wealth and influence, he decided instead of building houses all over the country or whatever, he wanted to help kids. And so that became a passion for him, and just such a godly man. And I remember Karen, when we started to date, she took me home for the first time to meet her family. And I was like, because they're from like the Philippines and Romania and Brazil and Korea. And I was like, this is like a meeting of the United Nations here. You know, it's crazy. But she moved here to pursue music. She says she made some phone calls, and one of those phone calls that she made led her to Charlie Allen, who she said, I'd like to talk to you about maybe working on my record. That was like phone call, Charlie. So Charlie calls me because I just finished his record. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey, Brian. He goes, I want you to meet this girl named Karen Williams and help me work on her record.
Karen.
Yeah. And I said, okay. He goes, look her up, meet us for lunch. So I go online at that time. I think it might have even been MySpace.
MySpace.
You know, and and I type in Karen. Hmm. Well, I did not know she spells her name Karyn, but I type in Karen, and there was an African-American pop singer. And I'm thinking, well, you know, okay, I've written, you know, so I can do that. I can get my groove on, you know. And so he tells her, meet us for lunch and my friend Brian White. Well, because she spelled her name with a Y, she spelled Brian, B-R-Y-A-N.
Which I wondered if we would get to that, because you probably get
a ton of it.
Yeah. The all the Brian time. White, the country singer.
Yeah, so Brian was the big 90s. You know, country singer, the duet with Shania and all that. So I go to lunch that next day and I'm sitting there waiting. And that, what I'm expecting and what she's expecting isn't what when she walked through the door, I'm like going, oh, okay. And she's looking over at me kind of like, whoa, you know, and we sat there that day.
You sure she wasn't going,
yeah.
Oh, wrong Brian White.
Well, probably was, you know. But that day, we met December 3rd, 2007. And that was it, man. I mean, I was like, oh, my gosh. I was like, all right, God, don't do this to me. Don't put this beautiful woman in my life who's godly and all that. And just, and I thought, you know what? It's an old thing I used to say in college. It's like, you'd rather believe a girl would date you than ask her and her say no. So you just kind of live the dream, you know. Right. So in my mind, I'm like, I'll just kind of hang out with her and we'll talk music as much as I can be around her. And this is cool. And fast forwarding all that, she was going to go home for Christmas. And I figured she probably had a line of guys back in Orlando waiting to, you know, take her out. And I'd ask her if she had ever seen the lights of Opryland during Christmas. And she said, no. And I said, well, you want to go? And she said, sure. And so she called one of her friends, told me later, she said, I think he asked me on a date. What should I do? And they said, well, you should go. So here I am. And then my wife's a little younger than me. And we were sitting there. We walked around Opryland until the janitor was like kind of pushing us out the door. Like, mm-hmm. Hey, you know, it's time to go. And I was just trying to hold on to every minute.
Yeah.
And so we sat down and we had found a little coffee shop and I went to pay the bill. They said, can we, you know, see your identification? I gave her my card and she laid my license back on the table and Karen reached across to grab it. And I thought, oh, this is when it all goes south. She's going to figure out that I'm how old I am. And
yeah.
And I said to her, I said, hey, I don't think you know how old I am. And she said, I don't think you know how I feel about you. And that was 2 weeks after we'd met. You know, so December 3rd, so she was going home on the 18th, and I was like, oh my gosh. And it was on. Yeah. And it was a God thing, dude. I'm just telling you. So we got married this October 9th of 2009, and it's been the most unbelievable thing in my life, how God is so good. And, you know, what the devil meant for bad, mm-hmm. God says, here you go, you know. Yeah. And I've talked about the redemptive nature of the Father and forgiveness and mercy and grace beyond. And so my wife is a Christian artist, so she tours. She just got done with the Big Daddy Weave, and she's out with Shonda Pierce. And she's an amazing partner in this journey that we are on together. And so in regards to B-R-Y-A-N White, you know, through the years, I would be playing somewhere. And someone would come and go, are you going to sing Rebecca Lynn tonight? I go, I'm not that guy. I remember when I was touring as Brian White and Justice, we were playing at Penn State, and we were in a auditorium, and people were standing out in the foyer, and we were sound checking, and I knew these people are showing up. They had cowboy hats on and crap, and I'm thinking, oh, they think I'm that guy. And so I told the band, I said, follow me. And I started, Rebecca Lynn was born in Kerala. And you could see them kind of like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm thinking, man, they're going to be
so. Hang on a second. The stature difference between the two of you.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a little dude.
Yeah. And it's funny because I before I met Brian, I met his brother, Daniel, who, and Daniel said, you know, my brother's Brian White. No, because my wife was doing some stuff. Mm-hmm. So I was walking out of the mall out here in Cool Springs and he was walking in and we passed each other. And I said, hey, you don't know me. I said, but I'm Brian White. And he goes, you're that Brian White. And he goes,
you're stealing my gigs.
Yeah. That way he goes,
you're playing my songs.
I get people wondering if I'm going to do, you know, this Christian rock thing. And I said, that's funny. So we became friends and we've written a couple times through the years. And he actually just texted yesterday to say, you know, hey, I hope the new year's great. And just, he's been a bud, but it's been a funny thing. Yeah. You know,
I will tell you this. I have my own little tiny Brian White story. I've never met him, but I was in Shoney's. Tell you how long ago this was. I was at the Shoney's breakfast buffet, and some woman screamed and dropped her plate and screamed, Brian White! And I turned around, and she was like, oh my God, it's Brian White! I'm like, no, but thank you. So I'm like, that was my...
You kind of have that vibe.
Well, I mean, and my hair was a little longer back then.
I can see that, totally. I mean, and he's a great guy and great friend. Mm-hmm. And we've laughed through the years. One of the funniest ones, I was playing the Bluebird, and I'm standing there before... We're sitting, getting sound checked, and I noticed this lady kind of sitting off to the side, and she comes walking up, and she's got literally a stack of, like, Tiger Beat and all that kind of magazine and records, and they're all Brian White. And she walks up to me, she goes, "Oh." And I said, "You're expecting that guy, right?" She goes, "Well, I saw it advertised and I thought, oh, I'm going to get all my stuff signed. And I drove down from Michigan," and I'm like, "Oh, wow." And I said, "I'm so sorry." And she goes, "Well, I'm sure you're good too." So I said, "Hold on a minute." So I pulled my phone up and I called Brian. I said, "Hey, there's a lady here." She didn't know what I was doing. I said, "Would you just talk to her?" So I said, "Hey, there's somebody who wants to talk to you." And I gave her the phone. Well, you would have thought I handed her $1 million because she was talking.
That's awesome.
So, but those things happen more times than you can imagine.
Yeah.
But it's a fun story for us.
Yeah. It's just in one letter and, you know, about 5 inches of height difference.
And probably a big difference in the bank account. You know, there's probably a few more commas or whatever before his, anyway, he's a dear friend.
Let's talk about what, you know, obviously you've got a great career as a songwriter, and I love seeing you and Karen together. I just think a joy to be around. Yeah. I love seeing you guys. And, let's talk about the 30A. You've got the hat on.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the 30A songwriter thing that you've been doing for a while, because I think that's pretty cool.
It's an awesome thing. It's 15 years ago, they started it, and we were playing a festival called the Frank Brown Songwriter Festival over in Gulf Shores. And these people came up and said, "Hey, would you guys ever do something like this with the group of people that we were with, Chaz Sanford, Pete Salas, some others?" Would you guys do a festival over here in Rosemary Beach? And we're like, "Yeah, it ain't hard to get songwriters to come to the beach." Yep. And they go, "Well, we do it in January, so they put it together. And that first couple of years, just started small. And, an organization, Russell Carter management, got a hold of, maybe we can kind of come in and help. And long story short, I've said that a few times, I guess, is that they kind of jumped on it, and they realized that Karen and I was doing, playing places and playing my country stuff. And then we'd throw a gospel song in because that's just who we are. And, he said, "Hey, I know you guys do that gospel thing. So if you're interested, we'll give you a Sunday morning if you want to do." Well, no one was playing on Sunday morning. These festivals are, they're all staying out late on Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And we were like, "Yeah." And so we were like, "We don't know if anybody will show up, but we'll do it." So the first couple of years we did it, 50, then 100 people. Well, then it kind of caught on, and they started calling it the Gospel Brunch. Because they said, "Well, we're going to put it over here at Caliza Pool," which is at Alice Beach. If you know anything about Rosemary Beach, it's gorgeous. Oh. And they had this pool area, and they put a tent up. Well, all of a sudden, 100 became 250, became 400, became turning people away.
Wow.
And the guys that were putting it together, I don't think had any idea what Christian music would do and could do. So we ended up, about 6 years ago, they came to us because we were literally turning away as many people. They were showing up an hour before the show just to stand outside in the cold, because in January, it's cold at Rosemary a lot of times. And they said, would you do two shows? And we're like, "Oh man." And And my fear was, I like 400 people packed in versus two shows of 200 people.
Yeah,
then it doesn't feel quite the same, that energy. And, it was like, God was like, I was the doubting Thomas. And it was like my wife and our friends were like, "You need to do this." And I was like, "Okay, we'll do it." And so the first year we did it, sold out the first show. And as the people were leaving the first show and we had a half hour break, I look out and the line is all the way around, and they sold out the second show.
Wow.
So we had two shows of about 400 people packed in, and it became this thing now. And we will travel around the country. Matter of fact, the reason we're in Tulsa that we do the event with you out there is that couple saw us at 30A at the Gospel Brunch and said, "We want what you and Karen do. We want to do it out here in Tulsa for this event." And so it's just, it's crazy how God has just kind of blessed that and multiplied the loaves and fishes, so to speak. And it's an opportunity for us to have a faith-based gospel show, if you call it a show, because it has to be at some point, with people who we call it church with a Bloody Mary, because people come in and they have their Bloody Mary in their hand and they're going it. but we're sharing the gospel. So over the years, Russell has been very kind to let us kind of handpick bringing our special guests, because at first they were just putting other writers in there. Yeah. And I remember one of our buddies, he's not a Christian writer. So he said, man, I don't have any Christian songs. So I'm just going to sing a couple hymns, you know, but it was just kind of funny. So when we realized what we were getting, what we were doing, Russell allowed us to kind of handpick some people. So we had Ben Glover came and played.
Mm-hmm. I love Ben.
And Ben is a great writer and producer.
Yeah.
And then we brought Mac Powell in. Mm-hmm. Well, all of a sudden now you're up in things and people are going, oh my gosh, that's the guy from Third Day, you know? And so we did that for 2 years. Then for 2 years we did Peter Furler and Duncan Phillips from the Newsboys, because Peter lives down there. Well, now that was a whole other thing. So then this year we had Ethan Hulse, and Ethan is, I call him K-Love Radio, because I said, you know,
he's written so many big songs.
Every time I turn on the radio, it's an Ethan Hulse song.
Yeah.
And the crowds have just continued to grow. And so we sell out two shows, and we have a chance to really present hope and the gospel to a lot of people who maybe don't even go to church on Sunday, but they'll come to this.
Yeah.
And it's just been one of the things that has surprised us at how the response has been. And it's 15 years now we've done it. So, and we look forward to continue to do it. We'd love to have you come down and sing. I'm telling you, all you got to do is stand up there and start singing those four hymn songs, which, by the way, I have to just tell you this. And you, the other day at Don's service, the way you guys handled Future Generations was unbelievable. It just had so much tenderness to it. But your voice is, and I'm not fanboying here on you, but I kind of am. There was nothing, no tricks. No, it was just you stepping up and singing, and it's such a pure, unbelievably great voice. And so you've always been, you know, you, well, all four of you. It took the four of you together to make what happened for him. But when each one of you would step out and feature, y'all had your thing, your texture, and I loved it, man, and still love it. You know, sometimes as you get older, well, maybe we need to lower that one, you know, because I can't hit that note anymore. But man, you're amazing.
Well, I tried to lower it, just so you know. When we came in, the piano player had it in the original key, and I said, "Can you play this in B flat instead of C?" And he goes, "Yeah, let me." And then it was like pretty rough. Like I knew he would get it. He's like, "Oh, by the time you sing it, I'll have it." I don't respond. I don't have a lot of faith in that. So I've heard that before. And I'm like, you know what? Just do it in the original key. Yeah. We'll be fine. And, you know, it's interesting. The older we get, the more funerals we go to. And, you know, not to wrap this up on a morbid side of things, but it's reality, you know? Yeah. And one thing I love about doing this podcast, I was able to get with Don and you know, get Don and Dave together to share their story. And I've heard from so many people. Just what a healing thing that was to hear Don, because he didn't tell his story very much in venues like this. And, you know, I think it's something we just have to kind of expect. But, you know, especially being in church ministry, I've sung at a lot of funerals, and I realized, you know, and you could probably, you know, parallel this to the songs that you write. I realized that one of the most important gifts that I can give people is to sing at a time of loss. I take it very seriously. And so many of the young worship leaders that I've led over the decades, one of the things I tell them is don't you dare turn down an invitation to sing at a funeral. Because I think that's a lot of why God gave us his voice. You know, it's to be joyful and it's to sing songs to lead people in praise and worship. But a lot of times our voice is best used to comfort people in times of need. Dude. And I'm not saying I look forward to singing at funerals. I don't. And I've sung at some really difficult ones over the last few years. But I understand the role of the voice that God has given me, that it does bring peace to people. And again, I take it very seriously. I try not to get up there and make it about me and the performance. It's about what I can do in the moment to bring peace. It was
every bit of that. It was beautiful. I mean, you know, and you said it's comfort. When my dad passed away a couple of years ago, I told my wife, we were driving up there, I said, I can't sing at my dad's funeral. There's just no way. And so we walked in, and my mom was standing there, and she said, well, you know, honey, I want you to sing the promise. Mm. And how do you tell your mom no? You
know? That's right.
And I just remember thinking, because my co-writer, Don, when we wrote it, his dad passed. He had it played at the funeral. And I jokingly said, oh, I never knew we wrote the best funeral song of all time. You know, that kind of thing. You don't set out to write a funeral song.
Right.
But the way the Martins did it, it's just healing. And I thought, just what you just said, I said, you know what? Hey, you don't tell your mom no. But I mean, that's what she wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. And that was what was going to be comfort to her. So get beyond, you know, it was my father. But also I thought it was like the Lord said, with Brian, it's time for you to hear the words yourself and apply those words yourself. All those words are good enough for everybody else. But now I'm going to let you speak that back into your own heart. And that day, you know, when I sang it and I broke down and cried at some points, but it was like the Lord was saying, you know, this gift that you've been sharing with everybody else today, I want it to be comfort and healing to your own heart. And so I know when you sang the other day, that was Don's song, but I know that his kids and his wife sat there and thought, wow. Dad was speaking to us, and you guys honored that so well. So I was blessed by it, and it was just a great way. And you didn't try to go out there and when I say this, you didn't try to for him it. Yeah. You know, like, man, we're gonna get bombastic and sing like it was. You just sang it so I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so moved, and every word was poignant, and so it was awesome.
Well, I think one of the gifts that we don't realize until we get older, we get to this age, you know, that we can look back and go, you know, God, you said it. We were writing these songs because it was our job and we were good at it and we were getting paid for it. And it was a way for us to do something we loved. But you get to a certain point in life, you go, wow, I was kind of setting myself up to receive those words back again. And I think that's one of the joys of being able to, oh, it's just, for lack of a better way to say it, we've lasted this long and we can see that come back around. And again, I think that's another just really gift from God. It's a little hug from God just to go, you see, I was putting these words in your mouth or in your pen so many years ago, and they're going to end up blessing you. And I think you and I will, the longer we live, we'll continue to see that.
You know, one of the great things of my voice was, I was a rock guy, you know, and so, you know, but when you can write a song and you get people who can deliver it with voices that you go, oh, you know, and I think that's been one of the fun things for me. I don't go back and listen to my songs as much to go, look what I wrote, as much as I do, oh, you know, when Michael English sings your song, you go, oh, listen to that voice, you know, when you guys sing my song. And that was just for me, God, thank you for allowing there to be somebody that can carry a tune and do it in a way that I never dreamt could be, you know, you write it in a room and then you get this guy who interprets it and you go, oh my gosh, that's how I dreamed it would come out. And so it's been an honor to be a part of your career and the artist that I get to write for. I feel very blessed that, I tell people all the time, I don't care if it's an independent artist or whoever it is, someone who thinks enough of what I wrote that they want to sing that to the people they're going to stand in front of, out of all the songs they could choose. So every cut, every person is, I feel as I'm honored to be a part of what they're doing. So it's cool for me, Andy, to have shared the shows that we've gotten to do with you, me, and Karen. And you were always... Here, I'll say it. You're always my favorite of the four hymns. I'm just kidding. And Mark and Kirk and Marty are going, what?
Did you hear that, guys?
No.
Did you hear
that? But, you know, it's been a cool thing for us to kind of look back. And the fun thing is, like, yeah, that was some years ago, but we just pick up like we never left, you know. And there's a history there that I cherish, and I feel very honored to be here today with you on your podcast. And, good stuff.
Hey, thanks for listening. Join me every Monday for new stories from the Christian music industry and beyond. And if you want more content like this, along with a lot of great music, join me for Worship with Andy Christman, airing on 500 stations around the world every weekend. And when you get a sec, run over to my website, andychristman.net, for information about my professional vocal coaching and an incredible new resource for worship pastors called The Worship Table. See you next time on the One Degree of Andy podcast.